This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, November 15th, 2007. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns. In today's program, the U.S. House passes a war funding bill that includes troop drawback provisions, German car makers resist CO2 emissions cuts, and the oil spill caused environmental devastation continues in San Francisco Bay. All this and more, but first, these news headlines.
I'm Anitra Grisales with these headlines. Israeli forces targeted airstrikes on a group of Palestinians in northern Gaza today, following a series of Palestinian homemade rocket attacks. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert has demanded Palestine recognize Israel as a Jewish state before the upcoming Middle East peace conference. Rami Amigari has more from Gaza.
Medical sources report that two Palestinian resistance fighters of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, linked to President Abbas's Fatah Party, were killed and seven others wounded, including two civilians, when Israeli aircraft hit targets in northern Gaza. The Israeli army said the airstrikes were in response to a barrage of homemade rockets, which Palestinian resistance factions fired into nearby Israeli areas, slightly wounding four Israelis in southern Israel. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert demanded yesterday that Palestinians recognize Israel as a Jewish state prior to the upcoming Washington-sponsored Middle East Peace Conference in Annapolis, Maryland, United States. Palestinians and Israelis have yet to agree on a joint document on core issues such as the borders of Palestinian state, the Palestinian refugee problem, and the status of Jerusalem, which U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has failed to secure despite repeated visits to the region. For Free Speech Radio News and IMEMC.org, this is Rami Almighari in Gaza.
A powerful cyclone with winds of up to 155 miles an hour is racing towards India after hitting Bangladesh's southern coast. Large-scale evacuation is underway in both countries. Bismillah Gilani reports from New Delhi.
Tens of thousands of people are being evacuated from coastal areas in the Indian states of West Bengal and Orissa, while about 600,000 people have already been moved to safer places in neighboring Bangladesh after the storm hit the country's southern coast this evening. According to the officials of Regional Meteorological Center, the storm is fast racing towards the West Bengal coast and was likely to make landfall with a speed of 180 to 200 kilometers per hour by midnight tonight. The Union Home Ministry has issued alert advisories to both states, and the Army is also on standby to assist civil administration in rescue and relief work. The cyclone, packing winds of speed up to 180 kilometers per hour, is the most severe after the supercyclone of 1999, which claimed more than 10,000 lives in Orissa. For FSRN, this is Bismillah Gilani from New Delhi.
A majority of member nations of the United Nations wants the world body's General Assembly to adopt a resolution against the death penalty. Haider Rizvi has more from the UN.
More than 90 countries, including all the 27 members of the European Union, have endorsed the proposed resolution against the death penalty, but it seems highly unlikely to pass due to strong opposition from a number of countries, including major powers such as the United States and China. Last year, 2,790 people were executed in China, while the United States put 53 people to death. Those in favor of the moratorium on the death penalty say the practice goes against the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But opponents argue that every country has the right to pursue its own course of legal actions. The vote is likely to take place later this evening. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
The Georgian parliament ruled today that they will lift the nationwide state of emergency tomorrow. But one independent television station will not be allowed back on the air. Deborah Wild has more from Tbilisi.
President Mikhail Saakashvili introduced the 15-day nationwide state of emergency after riot police dispersed opposition protests with tear gas and rubber bullets in the capital Tbilisi more than a week ago on November 7th. Two independent television stations were taken off the air and newscasts curtailed. The measures drew harsh criticism from the West. Nevertheless, a court has suspended the broadcasting license and froze the assets of Imedi TV, which is co-owned by Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation. The authorities claimed that the station's coverage of the November 7th events amounted to incitement to overthrow the government. The station's management has called the charges ludicrous and is planning an appeal. The opposition sees the media ban as a major obstacle to campaigning ahead of presidential elections scheduled for January 5th, 2008. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Deborah Wild in Tbilisi, Georgia.
Those are today's headlines. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Anitra Grisales.
Both the U.S. House and Senate are moving closer to passing surveillance legislation. At the heart of the debate are Fourth Amendment rights for Americans living abroad and the issue of immunity for telecommunications companies. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
The Senate surveillance legislation, which is still being formulated, aims to replace the president's so-called Protect America Act, which expires February. The Senate Judiciary Committee is in the middle of debating the tedious and complicated legislation, which allows unlimited foreign secret surveillance and sets some restrictions for the surveillance of Americans. But one issue at the center of the debate is expressed by Republican Senator John Kyle of Arizona. He says Americans venturing abroad lose some of their constitutional rights and can be monitored.
There is no basic constitutional right of an American abroad to be free from a search and seizure unless there is a court warrant obtained. And so I ask again, why should we set up such a procedure in a foreign intelligence gathering situation when it is not required to investigate a mere crime?
Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, Democrat of Rhode Island, says Congress must clarify Americans' rights.
The case law, I think, is pretty clear that it is unsettled to what extent the Fourth Amendment applies to Americans traveling abroad. It is far from clear that Americans lose their constitutional rights when they step over our borders. There is indeed case law to the contrary. And it is because that question is unsettled that we need to resolve it here.
On a party-line vote, the Democrats ensured protections for Americans living abroad. But some members say those protections don't go nearly far enough. The other contentious issue has to do with immunity for telecommunication companies. The White House and Republicans are demanding they be exonerated for providing the government with customers' communication records. As of now, the Senate bill excuses the telecoms, which would dissolve 40 lawsuits against the industry. But Lisa Graves with the Center for National Security Studies says the issue is still very much up in the air, even though the Senate Intelligence Committee already approved immunity.
The Senate Intelligence Committee basically gives a blank check, or what I would say is a blank checkbook, to the telephone companies, despite the plain language of the law that says that if they provide warrantless access to Americans' communications, they're liable for damages of up to $1,000 a day per person per violation. So the Senate Intelligence Committee really did away with that important protection for Americans' rights, and hopefully the Senate Judiciary Committee will not go along with that.
The Senate Judiciary Committee will vote in the coming day on whether they'll hold the telecommunication companies accountable. Telecom lobbyists and civil libertarians filled the hearing room monitoring the proceedings. The House version of the bill, which is to be voted on Thursday, does not include immunity, causing civil libertarians to champion that version of the bill. The administration, though, has issued a veto threat. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Former Speaker of the House Dennis Hastert has announced he will be stepping down from the Senate before the end of the year. The Illinois Republican had previously announced he would not seek re-election, but this early departure is somewhat surprising. He has not given a reason for his early retirement. Representative Hastert gave his farewell address on the House floor earlier today. He praised the work of current Speaker Nancy Pelosi and made a call for bipartisan politics.
I pray that God will give you and guide you in all that you do in these halls, that he gives you the knowledge to do the people's work, the strength to persevere, and the wisdom to know when to listen to what others have to say.
Hastert is the longest-serving Speaker of the House in U.S. history, serving from 1998 to 2007. Democrats in Illinois are already strategizing a run in Hastert's suburban district, one they think is now vulnerable for a Democratic takeover. Insufficient equipment, post-traumatic stress disorder, lack of readiness, and even some recruits getting waivers to join up after methamphetamine usage. These are just a few items on a growing list of problems that Army Chief of Staff General George Casey and Army Secretary Pete Garron brought to a hearing of the Senate Armed Services Committee today. General Casey says the Army needs funding to, quote, get back in balance, but at the hearing, some senators fired back and asked how we ended up with these problems in the first place. Karen Miller has more from D.C.
General Casey came to the committee talking about the hardships the Army has faced with recruiting and sustaining troops.
Our nation's been at war for over 6 years, and our Army has been a leader on the front lines of that war, both abroad and at home. Over time, these operations have expanded in scope and duration, and as a result, our all-volunteer force has been stretched and stressed.
But Senator Ted Kennedy, Democrat from Massachusetts, went on the attack asking why.
We're battling against Iraq of 25 million that had been beaten 10 years before, against whose army had been disbanded, military had been put in jail. 5 years later, you're saying the current demand on our forces exceeds the sustainable supply. Who is this mythical military that's battling and taking on an army of 1,300,000 people and find ourselves in this kind of shape? Who is this incredible military force that is challenging the greatest military force that we had, even in 9/11? Who are they?
Casey responded by saying that the problems with the current army went back to the 90s when decisions were made to shrink the military. He also said troops were not, quote, properly organized, trained, or equipped to take on Iraq or anything else. He then continued to paint a bleak picture for the years ahead.
We live in a world where global terrorism and extremist ideologies are reality. And as I look to the future, I believe that the next decades will be ones of what I call persistent conflict.
Casey also said that increased competition for oil resources will be a source of international conflict, and the U.S. military needed to be ready. But Senator Robert Byrd, Democrat from West Virginia, wanted clarification.
You appear to be suggesting that a primary justification for developing an expanded military is to secure adequate oil supplies for the U.S. If so, is that not an unrealistic objective? And would it not be more prudent to accelerate investment in infrastructure?
That was not what I was trying to suggest, Senator. I was just trying to point out the fact. I believe the competition, not just for oil resources, but for water and other things, is going to generate global competition. Now, whether it turns to conflict, it remains to be seen.
Casey went on to say that the U.S. cannot predict the time, nature, or location of future conflicts. Senator Jim Webb, Democrat from Virginia, questioned him on that, asking why, then, do we have so much focus on Iraq? Casey responded by saying the number of forces in Iraq does, in fact, increase the level of risk, but he said, quote, that level is acceptable. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
The U.S. House of Representatives narrowly passed an Iraq funding bill that includes a troop withdrawal measure. The $50 billion bill, one quarter of the president's 2008 war funding request, gathered the support of most progressive members of Congress, many of whom never voted for Iraq war funding in the past. Representative Lynn Woolsey, Democrat from California, interprets the legislation as a funded withdrawal of U.S. troops. The troop drawdown must begin in 30 days, even though the bill doesn't call for a complete withdrawal or set a deadline.
This bill is not perfect. It is the boldest step yet, however, and we must support it. I would not support it if we were not tying the funding to responsible redeployment. I would not support it unless there was a start date for the president to begin the redeployment of our brave men and women in uniform.
The bill leaves troops in the country for Iraqi assistance, security, and counterterrorism purposes. It also clarifies that all U.S. personnel must follow torture prohibitions and requires that all troops sent to Iraq are certified, trained, and equipped. 4 Republicans joined the Democrats, but 16 Democrats did not vote for the bill, most of them conservative Democrats who thought the legislation tied the hands of the president. The bill will now head to the Senate, where its journey will be much more difficult. One Democrat, Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin, has already announced he'll oppose it. He calls the bill weak because it doesn't include a firm deadline for a troop withdrawal.
And no, Mr. President, the bridge fund passed yesterday by the House isn't good enough. A goal for redeployment doesn't cut it. We need a binding deadline.
Republicans hope to offer their own version, a $70 billion war funding bill with no conditions attached. It's been over a week since a cargo ship struck a bridge in San Francisco Bay, spilling 58,000 gallons of fuel oil into the water. The following investigation has found that the ship's radar was operating properly, despite a statement by the ship's pilot that the equipment was malfunctioning. The U.S. Coast Guard is also taking some heat for their handling of the investigation. Under federal law, the ship's captain is responsible for ordering drug tests of the crew, but the tests were not administered until more than 2 days after the wreck. The Coast Guard is responsible for making sure the tests are complete within 32 hours of the incident. The Coast Guard has replaced the lead officer in charge of the investigation. Meanwhile, the spill continues to have an ecological impact on the bay, with numerous cities feeling the effects. As correspondent Aaron Siegel reports, the Dungeness crab fishery has been closed and cleanup efforts are slow.
As the days following the 58,000-gallon oil spill in San Francisco Bay unfolded, even more disastrous consequences became a reality for Northern California's biggest city. On the morning of November 14th, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, upon recommendation from several state agencies, including the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, issued a closing on all local fishing and crabbing, effectively shutting down the industries immediately around the bay. Chris Baker, a local crab fisherman, talked about his boat's excess of empty crab pots and how the ban affected him.
On the 15th, we normally come down here and open a crab down here, and we make around 10 to 20 grand. So we have no Christmas now. It kills the crab, it kills the fish, it has a lot of effect in the ocean. But yeah, it kills anything that comes in here. Sand, fleas, everything. Everything just dies from the oil.
Meanwhile, at Ocean Beach, volunteer emergency cleanup workers were being trained and equipped in protective clothing to go out and pick up oil. When asked when she knew when the projected reopening of the beaches would happen, Chris responded.
You know, we really don't. As long as it takes us to get the area cleaned up, right now we're hearing that some of the beaches could be closed up to a couple weeks. We've had overwhelming volunteer response. You know, people love their beaches. They love their national parks. People really want to help out. So as the city of San Francisco and the EPA has been holding trainings, then they've had overwhelming response from the public. People need to be trained on how to go in an area with toxic waste, and the trainings will show them how to do that. The trainings will also show them what they're looking for, how to assess the situation, how to clean up, and how to make sure that they stay out of harm's way themselves.
The International Bird Rescue and Rehabilitation Center, or IBRRC, in Cordelia, California, is as busy as it was in the days directly following the spill, as more and more birds are found. A continuing influx of both oil-soaked birds and willing volunteers have kept the center operating around the clock.
My name's Jay Cook. I first volunteered with IBRRC in the early 90s. I've been in the washroom and the rinse room, which takes the oiled birds and gets rid of the oil and then washes all the soap off of them, and then they go out to get dried before they try to float them again. It's very satisfying. It's very satisfying.
With no projected end date in sight, the city of San Francisco will continue cleanup efforts on all affected beaches. Juan Caro, a spokesman for the Coast Guard's Joint Information Center, said on Wednesday that closed beaches will be reopened once authorities determine on a case-by-case basis that the oil no longer poses a danger.
That was Aaron Siegel reporting from San Francisco. German car makers have come under fire today from their French and Italian counterparts for not doing enough to reduce CO2 emissions. In fact, German car emissions have increased, while French and Italian automakers have decreased emissions in their vehicles. Next month, the European Commission is due to outline proposals for reducing the carbon dioxide emissions in new cars by 2012. But the European Union Parliament recently proposed giving car manufacturers until 2015. For their part, environmentalists say the 2015 deadline is too long and binding targets are needed. Cinnamon Nepard has more from Berlin.
Michelle Kramer, transport spokesperson for the Green Party in the European Parliament in Brussels, says that voluntary targets for emissions reductions have been a big mistake.
The voluntary commitment was a license for them to sleep. And if we now are giving them more 3 years, that is a license to sleep longer 3 years, and that is a catastrophe.
Sigrid De Vries, Director of Communications for the European Automobile Manufacturers Association, or ACEA, based in Brussels, says the car industry isn't opposed to binding legislation because that would level the economic playing field. But she says the industry needs sufficient time to adapt, and another 3 years is a good thing.
Cars have long development and production cycles, and they also have a lifetime cycle. They are, once they are taken into production, their production will last for up to 7 years. And it's very difficult to make changes during their life cycle. It's very expensive. And therefore, it's very important to have significant and appropriate lead time ahead of new legal requirements, because these would apply to all new cars registered on the market.
But environmentalists say the industry has already had 13 years and doesn't need more time. They say car manufacturers are more focused on profit and not the environment. Werner Rey, head of the transport department of Friends of the Earth Germany, says the German car lobby is very powerful.
They finance politicians and they have close contacts with lots of parliamentarians. And that's the reason that nothing happened in the last 10 years in Germany. And there wasn't enough pressure for innovation on the German car industry.
But De Vries from the ACEA says it's not realistic for the car industry to just focus on technology.
The car industry cannot do this on its own. It's a responsibility to reduce CO2 emissions that should be taken by all relevant parties, the fuel industry, policymakers. They could look at taxation, for example, CO2-related taxation to influence consumer demand, and also to adjust infrastructure. And, of course, there's the driver and the car owner that have a role to play. Only slightly changing their driving style could already reduce CO2 emissions of up to 10%.
While all these factors have a role to play, Ray from Friends of the Earth Germany says that legally binding agreements for car manufacturers are the most important step in effectively reducing car emissions.
The sanctions must be so high that it's really worthwhile investing into efficiency techniques and reducing emissions. If the fines aren't high enough, it won't work. But the second point is that national governments have to do their jobs as well and have to change incentives. That means the car taxes have to be switched to CO2 basis in Germany.
Car manufacturers argue that with limits on emissions, the cost of buying a car will go up significantly for consumers, and nobody wants to pay for that. But environmentalists say the trade-off can be likened to the cheaper running costs of more energy-efficient refrigerators. Or if you want to look at it another way, Greens parliamentarian Michael Kramer says that we should think of CO2 emissions in the same way as CFC emissions or asbestos, in that if we don't make rapid and significant change, our very existence is threatened. However, it's not just about technological change, but a change in culture as well. Take Germany's infamous Autobahn or highway system.
We are the only country all over the world which has no speed limit, and the car industry is arguing, okay, when we have a speed limit, we can't sell our big cars. If it is reality, the Japanese or American industry wouldn't sell a car because they have a very strong speed limit all over the United States. They have lots of highways, more highways than we have, and they have big cars, but they have a speed limit. And we have, for example, tourist groups which go by aeroplane from Tokyo to Frankfurt on a weekend, rent a car and drive 200, 250 all over the highways, and then they go back by plane. That is unacceptable. That is idiocracy.
With the German government calling on the Commission to allow heavier cars to pollute more, it looks like the French are leading the way in the fight to curb car emissions in the EU, with even President Sarkozy suggesting last week that there should be a ban on building new highways. The EU Commission will present its CO2 emissions reduction proposal on December 5th. Cinnamon Nippard reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Berlin.
Welcome to Island Paradise is the sign that greets visitors to Bazilan Island in the South Pacific. However, there are no longer international tourists on the palm fringe beaches. The Sulu Archipelago in the southern Philippines is renowned for the wrong reasons. It's home to Abu Sayyaf, a homegrown, small, but vicious militant group with the stated goal of creating an Islamic State. Washington, Manila, and Brussels have added it to their list of terrorist organizations, and thousands of troops from Manila, backed by the United States, have been sent to destroy the radical group. They claim they're close to wiping Abu Sayyaf out after killing senior leaders. But most locals think poverty, rather than Islamic ideology, is to blame for the rise of the terrorist organization. Rebecca Hinschke investigates from Basilan.
Salam spoons out rice to her extended family on the wooden floor of her one-bedroom house in Tipo-Tipo proper. "Come eat with us," she cries. But she already has enough mouths to feed.
So before, there were only three in the house. Now they became 13 because of the two families that moved here in his house.
Zahida Alassa from the local aid group Nagdilalab is on a tour of her village. She's here to see those displaced by the latest clashes between the military and the armed rebel groups.
In our culture here in Basilan, there are no evacuation centers provided for IDPs, but instead they move with their families instead.
There is widespread malnutrition among the children here and a very high illiteracy rate. This has been deemed the poorest region in the Philippines. But Manila has sent more than 3,000 troops to this island to wipe out Abu Sayyaf, whose members they believe now number less than 100. Driving across the fertile tropical island, there is an extremely heavy military presence. At every kilometre, there is a checkpoint. Tanks roll down the streets. Local Muslims complain of being treated as rebels. Joy Zabala has seen decades of conflict here. Her husband is a soldier, and she's part of the ceasefire monitoring team set up in 2003.
If people oftenly see and experience abuses from the military, they will be forced, yes, especially taking into consideration culture, the tribes has the bandings.
A U.S. helicopter lands in the military camp Lubis in Isabela City. Brigadier General Juancho Saban explains that they're working very closely with the Americans to eradicate Abu Sayyaf.
We're waiting for the Australians. They're coming.
But he's angry at any suggestion the military is fueling the conflict.
I think you are talking to the wrong people. I don't believe what you're saying, that they don't want the military here. Big portion of our military presence here is because of our engineering battalion. People are requesting us to construct their roads, construct their schoolhouses for children to be prevented from being the next generation of Abu Sayyaf or JI.
The military insists they're winning the hearts and minds of the people. But back over at the local NGO, Nadilabab, Detet Suachio is convinced that as long as the Manila government is intent on eradicating Abu Sayyaf with force, they will be unsuccessful.
These young people who are now rebels are the children of the children of those that the military killed before. So it just becomes a cycle of violence. And then what do we teach them? And what do they see? It's the same thing, killing here, killing there. So what will be the future if we will not stop this offensive?
They're trying to teach young people something different with a newly opened training center.
8 months.
8 months. Back in Tipo-Tipo proper, I asked two young boys if they're interested in joining the military or Abu Sayyaf. Neither, they reply. I just want to be a farmer, one boy answers.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.